can speak right into it. It should work quite nicely for everybody behind you.
Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Clark.
Yeah, that's my property there, or our property.
Yes, that's going to be the first item of business. So it looks like you're right on the terrace, over the top of the shadow roof.
That's correct. That property there is about 120 feet directly above the Shotover River. My initial submission asked for this process to be done again. I'm appealing to you now for your sense of what is right. The QLDC and the Maori people have clearly been working on Wahi Tapuna for a long time. The submissions given to you and the official reply sent to Reuben Bryant from the council proves that there was no consultation whatsoever with the landowners prior to the 10th of September 2019. The first occasion that we, the landowners, had to discuss this issue as a community was at the St Margaret's Church on the 19th of September, and there wasn't even a representative from the Maori people there to answer our questions. At this stage, the process had already been predetermined and finalised in the minds of the council and the Rakuna. The planner for the QLDC, Mrs. Pickard, has said that too much time and money has already spent on this for this process to be restarted. I put to you that this comment is irrelevant and that this is going to be law and it will be very hard to change this in the future. So it is important that we get this right. Please let the landowners investigate into keeping this process inside the QLDC. The RMA requires open discussion regarding something like this. This hasn't been done, and it has been deliberately kept out of public view. Let us use the carefully selected information presented to you and have it used by some person or persons inside the council delegated to the process of looking after the Wahi Tapuna issues. This will mean that only on very specific cases would the council refer the applications to an external authority for consideration. By having all applications dealt with in this manner, I think we'll avoid the bad feeling of distrust being created every time an applicant sees that they have to pay extra to a Maori culture to protect their heritage, when we know this culture has a huge advantage over the rest of the population and that they don't pay tax and given privileges that the rest of the population are not given. Please let us look into how we can have the right Wahi Tapuna process kept inside the QLDC. Referring the applications to Rakuna opens the process up to the unsavoury business of koha and unlimited time restraints. Let us not develop a barrier between cultures. Putting this through as it is presently structured will do that. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
It's rural.
And just residential purposes at this stage, or other activities
What we have, it's been, the place is called Trelawn Place. It's one of the oldest bed and breakfasts in New Zealand.
What you're asking for, though.
Mr. Smith.
know what elevation above sea level your property is at?
It's around about the 400 metres.
Thank you very much. That's all helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clark. We appreciate you taking the time to come and talk to us. And informing us where you come from, it's all useful information to feed into our consideration of what's going on.
Thank you.
Kia ora koutou. My name's Trent Yeo and I'm director of ZJV. Which is an adventure tourism, ecotourism business in Bob's Peak, and takes guests on a guided zipline tour from the top of the Ben Lomond Reserve through the forest canopy and connecting aerial treetop platforms that descend down the mountain. Environmental sustainability is the heart of our business, and we've won numerous awards for sustainability since opening in 2009. We run and support numerous social and environmental initiatives in the community, run solar power systems, plant thousands of native trees, repatriate biodiversity through wilding removal and pest removal, and soon to be future fit, internationally benchmarked, and the only tourism business to be certified zero carbon in the district. ZipTrek Eco Tours supports the intent of Chapter 39 and has reviewed the council's latest version. It is concerned about the proposed Chapter 39 that will create unnecessary costs, delays and uncertainty for very minor works that ZipTrek EcoTours seeks to undertake. ZipTrek's submission on the proposed plan concerns the extent of mapping in the Wahitapuna overlay on Queenstown Hill, in that it is very large and very general. I'm sorry, that should probably be Ben Lomond Reserve, not Queenstown Hill. My apologies. The permitted earthworks allowance within that area being 10 metres cubed, where in the underlying informal recreation reserve the permitted allowance is 100 metres cubed. And the drafting in Chapter 39 to be revisited to clarify whether the standards were applying to only identified Wahitapuna areas. In the latest version of the provisions, I see that the term identified is proposed to be included, which essentially addresses the uncertainty of drafting issues. How the rules apply to ZipTrek EcoTours. ZipTrek's operations are with Te Taumata o Haki Takura, Site 27, which is listed specifically in the proposed Rule 25.5.11 as being subject to the 10 metre cube restriction of earthworks. The site is valued Wahi Toaka, and the threats are exotic species, including wilding pines, buildings and structures, utilities, new roads, additions, alterations to existing roads, vehicle tracks and driveways, activities affecting the ridgeline and the upper slopes. Even if Site 27 were not included in 25.5.11, Rule 25.5.22 would apply, as our location is above the 400 metre altitude, except at the very base. Rule 25.3.2.9 provides the earthworks shall be calculated by the sum of all earth that is moved within a site and includes a total of any combined cut and fill for a 12-month period. This constrains the makeup to 10 metres cubed. What ZipTrek EcoTours seeks and why? Primarily, we seek that the permitted earthworks allowed to be increased to 100 metres cubed so that consent is not required for minor activities which we seek to undertake. Another option that reflects our submission would be to consider Site 27 itself with greater specificity to determine that this receiving environment can in fact handle, setting a threshold no more restrictive than required to appropriately address adverse environmental effects. I recognise Mr. Mathgate's evidence states that some of wahi tapuna are particularly high value, particularly those considered tapu, and we especially and will be especially sensitive to any modification by earthworks. But the wahi tapuna area affecting our site is a large landscape within which I see minor earthworks cannot cause such an effect, and that it needs to be considered through a resource consent process. There is no explanation, clear explanation, of why the 10 metre threshold is appropriate. I also note that many of the other sites list earthworks as a specific threat, but Site 27 does not. It lists activities affecting the ridgeline and upper slopes, so it's not clear that the minor earthworks will be of concern because it is so general. On the other hand, the rule will have an impact on Ziptree Kokatua's operation in terms of costs and consenting and delays processing of the consents. Scale and extent. The area we lightly inhabit is of steep to very steep, highly treed and a landscape scale. On a steep site, it's very easy to exceed 10 metres cubed with any land work undertaken. We try not to undertake too many works in order to impact the environment unnecessarily, but cases where we might need to move land are where there has been natural land slippage over trails due to natural erosion, new trails and track maintenance, planting and ecological land improvement, and maintaining our treetop platforms. In the case of this active recreation zone, the scale of our impact is minuscule compared to the scale of Skyline Gondola, mountain bike park, and in fact, almost every other recreation type. So one of the requirements is that we maintain the area. So my main concern is around trail maintenance and natural slippage, because the land is very steep. I suppose I just want you guys to understand in this case the very steep nature of the land, and it is extremely easy to move 10 metres cubed. So I just don't want to get tripped up with paperwork and consenting matters. We don't expect to do anything, but if we have to, we don't want to have to go through a consent to do so. And we definitely play by the book inside that area, so we definitely would go through consenting if that was obviously required. Once again, we don't intend to, but we do tree work and ecological work. We've done thousands of trees planted in the area, and sometimes we move around soil. We very rarely do any with any other means than by hand. I can't even recall actually having a machine in there for any work that Ziptrek's done outside trail development in conjunction with council. I can maybe add that it may be seen counterintuitive for us to oppose this or be concerned by this, because actually we see it sets a good precedent over land management, particularly overland water erosion created by earthworks in the area, which is currently, in my opinion, not very well assessed. And we are the ones who do the very least of it.
I'm thinking that one of the issues we're working through and talk to Karanaka about is whether there is scope for additional carve-outs. It occurs to me that I can understand might be basis for treating maintenance of existing tracks differently to cutting new tracks, because particularly in a in an area that's sensitive to Runaka and indeed to population of Queenstown, cutting new tracks on the Ben Lomond Reserve is likely to attract attention no matter who's doing it or for what purpose. But do you think what proportion of your issues are about, as you've described it, maintaining existing tracks?
It's all I can foresee in the future is maintaining existing tracks has been an issue here. I suppose I don't want to shoot myself in the foot. If because one of the things that we're facing now is because of the Skyline development over the next 2 years, we may actually have to cut new track because we can't access the road, and we walk up the road as our part of our tour. So I suppose I'm just trying to leave this wide enough open so that it's a practical view, and we're not at all intending to do anything crazy. And in fact, the work that we do is just absolutely minuscule compared to every other user on the hill, I would say. So it's more a contextualisation about what 10 square metres means on a steep terrain.
So just one clarification. When you see it, I think you said it was all the work you've done is hand out and not machinery. How many people are doing it? 10 cubic metres to do it by hand is quite a lot.
Yeah, we do it. We do it consistently. Like, for example, trail maintenance is done throughout the year, and we do it in between tours. So it may seem like a lot, but and it is a lot if you're doing it in one go, but it's not a lot if you're doing it over time.
So in that respect, you're talking about the sort of this linear nature, and it's the combined length as opposed to
the correct, right? Yeah. So that's when you get a long trail, it multiplies very fast.
Thank you. I'm just interested to know what's the most restrictive regime you're under. Is it the Reserves Act, the lease under the Reserves Act, the Reserve Management Plan, the resource consent conditions, or these provisions that are proposed?
I would say that each has its characteristic challenges borders or fences, and so depending on the work that we do, it's changed. Like, for example, sometimes we're doing emergency tree work, right? And so we've been tripped up trying to remedy emergency tree work. We've been charged back logs, which are conifers, at whatever the rate was. There's been many situations where ZipTrex had to deal with the strict by the letter rules when we are kind of the only ones really following any of the rules in there. So there's no specific area that I would point to in answer to your question.
Are the conditions of your lease quite restrictive though?
Yeah, sometimes they have very, very weird phrases which we questioned at the time and were told that's how it is. So then we have to balance that up with getting through the process. Yeah, there's some really weird terms in our lease. Yeah, I would like to rewrite the lease, but I don't want to rewrite the lease.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Dawson.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. I just want to make sure I'm clear. What we ask several of the people that come is, are they in an urban area or are they in an open space and recreation zone? And you're saying your area is covered by, I think, informal recreation zone. So am I right in thinking that even though the general rule for earthworks at 10 square metres is exempt, the urban areas are exempt from that, in your case that doesn't matter because there's a specific rule that refers to your wahi tupuna that says it doesn't matter what zone you're in, you must meet the 10 square metre, cubic metre, I mean, rule. Is that right? That's the...
That's what we understand. Yeah. Yes, that was what was related to me through my lawyers looking through potential effects.
Yeah, so that rule doesn't exempt. Urban areas aren't exempt from that rule, even though they are from 25.5.22, which is the general rule.
I think it's outside the urban growth boundary anyway.
No, but the open space zones are
if they're within the urban growth boundary.
Oh, beg your pardon, within the urban growth boundary, yes, I haven't picked that up either.
There's many overlays.
Yeah, okay, I understand.
I think we understand it correctly, is that...
I think you do.
Right, yep,
yes.
Okay.
Thank you for drawing that to our attention.
No problem.
Thank you.
Yep. I think you understand the end result correctly. Yeah. Not sure about the route, but the result's the thing. Mm. So we understand where you're coming from.
Okay.
Well, that's good.
Thank you.
Any more for any more?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Nahimi. My name is Doug Bailey. I live in the Closeburn area. We're adjacent broadly to the Punatapu area, site 16.
Just if you just hold that thought, I might have to pull it up.
Have you got an address, like a street?
607 the Queenstown Glenorchy Road. Queenstown Glenorchy Road.
Glenorchy,
Queenstown. Tommy Tuppen's Drive. It's about 3 or 4 kilometres away from the Tauraka Waka at Bob's Cove.
Can you show me, Commissioner Dawson, should just turn around the camera?
Sorry, let me just turn my head.
I can't get the exact date.
607?
Geary Lane would be the nearest road reference that might be useful.
So where is Mr. Clark? We heard from this morning, he's on the top side of that road. You're on the bottom side of it.
On the other side of it,
yeah.
Between Moke Lake and Moke Lake Road and the Glenorchy Queenstown Road.
Oh, so you're on the north side of the Glenorchy Queenstown Road?
On the northeast.
Oh yes, so
where are you compared with? Oh.
Directly opposite Geary Lane on the upper side.
Oh, okay.
So in fact, you're on the same side as Mr. Clark.
Yeah.
He was like 4 or 5 along Europe.
Yeah, well, that will do. It's sufficient for present purposes.
Yeah,
because my submission is more of a general nature. I should say that I'm a retired lawyer, which I guess equates to senility at this stage. But I also think but I should also say that I was principal author of the State Services Commission's policy on bicultural perspectives, and it's relevant for me to note that, because whilst nominally I oppose the Wāhi Tupuna policy as it's outlined here, as it stands, I'm actually very supportive of the principle that mana whenua should be actively and materially involved in decision-making affecting cultural values and important sites. So my opposition is based on what I see as being the very fundamental flaws in this policy. There's three aspects to this that I will address. One is what I consider to be the complete inadequacy of this document as a consultation document. It's got a number of flaws where there are no clear relationships between threats, activities, and values, and there's a risk of it being seen, if not in practice, being arbitrary in its application. And I think the net effect of this over time will be to actually erode public support for something that's actually very important and captured in the resource management legislation and the heritage legislation. So that's an important qualifier to my opposition. And if I may, I'll just quickly go through my principal concerns, starting really with the, bear with me. Yeah, I'll look at the main deficiencies as I see it and then turn briefly to the application of the policy to Punatapu and Site 16 generally. I think there's two aspects at a high level There is no foundation provided between the values that are asserted and the areas that have been defined. I've been through all of the available references and I've listed them in my submission, including the Ngāi Tahu Atlas, the claim settlement legislation, the submission, the Crown assessment of the leasehold review for Closeburn Station. All of them are unanimous in their declaration that there is no evidence of significant cultural interest, and none was claimed by Ngāi Tahu in its own assessments when going through the treaty settlement process. There are areas, and I've already mentioned the area at Bob's Cove, where there is evidence of engagement, and there is also evidence, of course, for the area in the Queenstown CBD. But another fundamental flaw of this is that where there is foundation, we have the situation where there's a carve-out. So we end up with the rather perverse situation where the rules will apply in areas for which there is no adequate foundation that can be established for a cultural interest or value, and yet a carve-out for those areas where there is, which seems to me to be at best arbitrary and also convenient for those in the CBD. And the argument which seemed to be advanced in the background material to the policy was that the damage has already been done in the CBD. No such carve-out or exception is mentioned in the Principles of the Resource Management Act or in the heritage legislation. So I think if you're going to have a rule that needs to apply across the board, and there needs to be clear foundation. A similar problem arises in respect of threats, values, threats, and activity. There is no hierarchy to actually establish what a threat is and what activities therefore relate to it. So a threat is an activity, and an activity is a threat. If you look at the document, it's very, very unclear. So the application of rules is going to be, on this basis, would be highly, highly arbitrary. And there'll be no clarity for applicants or people engaged in any sort of activity about what is and is not going to be relevant. There is also potentially going to be a lack of transparency about how decisions are made. If there's no clarity about the hierarchy of the relationship between an activity and a threat and how that threat relates to values, you can see the confusion that's going to arise. In my submission, this is going to further make this policy further subject to judicial review, and certainly perceptions that somehow special relationships or decisions may be made either improperly, and I'm not suggesting a way would be, but without a logical and transparent basis. Now, the perception may be unjustified, but there's nothing in this policy as it's articulated that would actually give someone confidence that what they were doing is an activity which constitutes a threat in an overt way, and that there's a direct relationship, therefore, to values for which there has been an established foundation, evidence of cultural interest. That's a considerable concern to me. So we get the situation where if somebody's putting a solar power panel on their house, that this is, according to the document, an activity which is also a threat and therefore will require a cultural assessment. You can see we get to a sort of a reductio absurdum argument situation where people are having to, I think it speaks for itself. I won't prolong that one. So that conflation is a particular concern for me, as is the variable application of the policy. So I'd like to see a situation where it's applied uniformly with a rational basis. My submission would be that the council should actually rethink and redraw this policy. It is so flawed in my view. Just turning briefly to Punatapu, I think as a local resident, that absolutely is an area where there is an appropriate recognition of Ngāi Tahu's interest, and the decision making should materially involve them. So I'm very supportive of that. The open question, though, is that why the entire area of Site 16 has been included. Again, there is no apparent foundation or basis upon which this can be done. Now, you can assert, arguably, very legitimately, that Kaitahu have an interest in the entire whenua, and that it's a cultural value, and as kaitiaki, they have a material interest in the decision-making. I would not argue with that necessarily, but I don't think that this is the appropriate vehicle to be advancing this, given the costs and delays and potential problems that are going to arise as the policy is written. Written a more developed policy proposal, different story, and I might take an entirely different position, because as I said, I hope clearly enough, I'm actually very supportive of the principle, particularly in the legislation. So that's the essence of my submission. There are no particularities about it at all, just a wider concern. I would like to see a policy succeed. I would like it to have public support, but I don't think, as it's currently conceived, it will achieve that. I think the effect is actually going to be to the contrary. So thank you very much, commissioners. Appreciate your time.
The question, to make it succeed, in a nutshell, what does it need? Does it doesn't need much greater specificity,
yep,
in your view, in terms of this what you say is this confusion between threats and activities. What you say there should be a set of activities with the threat, the actual threat?
It's a basic hierarchy. Here is your set of values. Here are the potential areas of threat, earth moving, et cetera, development generally. Here are the activities underneath that link logically to those threats,
or not,
as the case may be, so that there's a basis available to, you know, any punter saying, right, if I put a solar panel on my house, is this a threat? Is this an activity which constitutes a threat, and therefore, but at the moment it's just not, it's not clear.
Discussion with a witness, a planning witness this morning, that in effect this plan does the same thing with outstanding natural landscapes. It draws a line around urban areas and says, although particularly small urban areas, it says we will treat these as not part of the O&L. There is a certain suspension of disbelief here because clearly, look down in Queenstown Bay, notwithstanding the best efforts of various developers, it's still pretty amazing. And so the question is that the same analogy?
No, it's not. In my submission.
Talk to me about the differences, as you said.
Well, we have where there is evidence of established settlement, archaeological importance, or reliable evidence of high cultural interest, all of which exists for the CBD area, that is given appropriate recognition as mandated by the Resource Management Act and the heritage legislation. So immediately there is a presumption that those areas will be included in any policy. Now, that presumption can be rebutted, but it should, if it's going to be rebutted, it should be done on an overt basis, a transparent basis. I have to say, and this is possibly unfair, but my first reaction, and I suspect it would be a public reaction, is, oh, great, you know, a nice carve-out for the commercial interests in Queenstown, and the public, the ordinary punters, have to pay the costs of cultural assessments. That was my initial reaction, not rational, perhaps. Or is it?
Yeah, there are still people who live in the Queenstown urban area, so I'm told.
Indeed. Yeah, so why should they not have to go through the, a cultural impact assessment for putting a solar panel on their roof when I might have to?
Well, possibly because you're in a rural area, and which comes Yeah,
but the act isn't specific to that. The principle is that the mana whenua will their interests will be recognised. Full stop.
Well, given this solar panel example, I understand you're using it as an example. I just record that the Runaka and indeed the council have recommended a rule to allow people to put solar panels on their wall as a carport.
Well, it's appropriate.
So it doesn't diminish from your argument because you're only using an example. You don't need to tell me that.
I appreciate you playing devil's advocate on it, yeah. I do think, though, that this is very susceptible of judicial review, just as a basic consultation document. My background has included a lot of policy development, and this is just simply not in a state where people can really engage in an informed way. It's a half-formed policy.
The other observation is that having sat on a number of these district planning processes, it's not so much a judicial review, that there's an open right for all players to appeal to the Environment Court, and no one's been slow to take up that and I don't imagine for a moment they'll be slow in the future. Mr. Dawson.
No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you very much for giving us your thoughts in writing. We've all read it's very much appreciated that you took the time to do that, especially given that I think the message came through from Kat, but you tried to put it down on paper to keep going. I'm familiar with that model.
Yeah.
Saying that we've got...
You carry on, because the first thing I was going to ask you was, like Mr. Bailey, to ask you to point out exactly where you are located, so we get a clear fix. Because
it's already
I can't
it's already
see very
up
clearly,
there.
But yes, I think that's correct. Number 1 and number 11 Close Burn Road.
Yep.
So I think that's correct.
Yes.
Yes, that's a giveaway. It's got your name on it.
Makes it a bit easier, doesn't it?
You stay here.
Okay. I'd prefer not to hold the microphone, but can you hear me clearly enough without it?
So can you hold it?
Okay. given the fact that we, as you said, our evidence kept growing and it is rather long, we've actually prepared a shorter statement or version, if we want to call it that, that we thought we could share with you now, and then that would allow more time afterwards for some questions if you would like to ask questions.
That would be helpful.
Summary
of
We actually have a copy of what we're going to say now for each of you, just to make it a little easier to follow along.
Thank you for that.
Can you please pour some water?
Thank you. scheduled you for a full hour, so by all means.
Okay.
Yep.
Kia ora koutou, commissioners and those present today. We are Ewan and Heather Rendell, submitter number 3207, and owners of property at Close Fern, Mapton, Wahi Te Puna site, number 16 Punatapu, which you can see up there. We speak as concerned landowners and ratepayers who wish to see the formation of fair and reasonable policy for all. As lay people, we have some experience with resort consent processes. We do not pertain to be legal, planning or cultural experts. Initially, we'd like to draw the Commissioner's attention to the fact that throughout our submission and our pre-lodged evidence, we've questioned certain aspects or points. We do so to draw your attention to those points for further consideration in your decision-making process, rather than to ask for direct answers from yourselves today. We'd also like to take the opportunity now to point out that Sarah Pickard for QLDC, in her summary of evidence spoken to on the 29th of June 2020, incorrectly implies that we have asked for Lake Hayes to be included in the mapping. Her sentence in 4A states, for example, the inclusion of Lake Hayes as suggested by Rendell, submitter number 3207. To clarify, we questioned why a number of areas, including Lake Hayes, had been omitted from the mapping, as the mapping appeared inconsistent. At no time did we request for those areas to be included. So we'd like to further comment on the latest QLDC policy revisions that they've brought up and draw your attention to the following three key points of concern. So the first is policy, the lack of criteria and clarity set by QLDC for the policy. Two, evidence or lack of it to support the mapping and Wahi Te Puna designation of all properties within each of the sites. And three, number 16 Punatapu area, its extended size and what appears to be the lack of relevance and values for much of the area, including our properties located in Close Fern. So with regard to the revisions, the latest QLDC proposed policy provisions primarily driven by Renaka's requests are even more onerous than the previous versions. Our number 16 Punatapu rural residential properties. Anything and everything may now have significant adverse effects on Mana Whenua's values and must be avoided. That's revision 39213 and 39214. Revision 39216 implies a CIA report may be required for any activities, even if you've consulted with Mana Whenua. Further to our comments in our hearing evidence 5.2 regarding earthworks, we consider proposed standards rule 25.5.22 sets a subjective framework, provides less clarity and will incur additional expenses for affected landowners. Many landowners will now unknowingly be caught by the provisions. If these provisions are retained, we consider the 400 MASL elevation in 22.5.22.2 is too low and does not take into consideration the topography and existing built environment. View planes resulting from 22.5.22.3 would be highly subjective, and it's unclear whether an adjacent site is a neighbouring lot or a listed Wahi Te Puna area. Incidentally, Michael Bathgate for Runaka and subsequently QLDC's revisions have now introduced the wording terrace edge to 22.5.22.3. Neither the policy or previous reports, as far as we can see, note terraces or terrace edges of being importance or requiring protection. So on our key points, key point number one, policy, criteria and clarity. As we point out in our hearing evidence, the entire process has been shambolic, resulting in policy not fit for purpose. We believe policy to address Māori cultural values should have been integrated throughout the existing chapters in the district plan, utilising Chapter 5 Tangata Whenua to inform purpose and to provide specific directives. In its current form, we consider the policy to be unnecessarily divisive. QLDC failed to set criteria and to provide clarity for, one, what constitutes a sufficient level of significance for Wāhi Tupuna designation under the district plan, two, what can be afforded protection under the district plan, particularly with regard to the intangible, and three, to enable anyone other than Mana Whenua to independently assess how the threats apply to a project and what constitutes more than minor, given that the threats have been broadly stated with little to no definition. Buildings and structures is one of those threats, and as we point out in our submission, 39212C is open-ended, which presents a huge grey area and a threat to landowners. The policy ensures that only Mana Whenua are able to determine whether a project may or may not have adverse effects. Consequently, QLDC planners have no way of determining whether Mana Whenua's requirements, if they have any, are fair and reasonable for both iwi and landowners. This will result in commissioners and or the Environmental Court having to make rulings on projects which may well have been complying activities in the underlying zoning. In many instances, landowners with a Wāhi Tupuna overlay will be subjected to any or all of the following additional costs: Mana Whenua consultations and or CIAs, QLDC resource consent charges, including application fees, initial project rates, and generally additional hourly charges for engineering, planners, peer reviews, and monitoring, then surveying, independent planners, and lawyers. So our key point number two, evidence, mapping, and designation. Based on Council's evidence, it does indeed appear they chose to bypass a crucial step in the overall process by not requiring Mana Whenua to provide any specific evidence other than the mapping to verify the Wāhi Tupuna sites or inclusion of individual properties within those sites. As we point out in our hearing evidence 3.7, QLDC and Runaka obviously chose not to follow any stringent guidelines like those set by Heritage New Zealand Pohare Tauonga Act 2014, which would have required adhering to certain criteria, provision of evidence and consultation with landowners. Currently, there are only 10 Wāhi Tupuna sites listed in the entire country, Waitangi being the first. Also of note, there are currently no Wāhi Tapu or Wāhi Tupuna listings for the Whakatipu area. It appears that out of respect, Mana Whenua were not required to identify what specific features or aspects are to be protected on individual properties and why. As we point out and question in our hearing evidence 313, Mana Whenua prefer to keep individual sites and certain cultural aspects secret. With all due respect to Mana Whenua, is the district plan required to protect secrets? So our key point number three, Puna Tapu. So Puna Tapu, meaning sacred spring, on Ngāi Tahu's own Kahuru Manu website mapping is marked as being in or on the water within what is known as Bob's Cove. The site shows no Ka'ara Tupuna trails, depicted by green lines, or Ngā Ingoa Awa rivers depicted by blue lines in the area. And our screenshots with our evidence on E5 and E7 show screenshots of their website mapping. Mana whenua have listed three values for the area: Tauraka Waka, settlements, and archaeological. And there are four threats listed: earthworks, subdivision and development, buildings and structures, energy and utilities. As stated in both our submission and hearing evidence, the values chosen by Mana whenua for the area don't appear to hold standing to the land outside of the immediate Punitapu Bob's Cove location. This Wahi Tapuna area includes land up to 13 kilometres from Punitapu Bob's Cove, which is already substantially developed. To date, there has been no evidence produced to corroborate the inclusion of such a vast tract of land and our properties within it. QLDC made no effort to evidence the inclusion of the hundreds of properties within number 16 Punitapu, intended to be designated Wahi Tapuna, other than to rely on the mapping provided by Runaka. We do not consider it fair and reasonable practice to broadly map to capture considerably larger area than the actual specific sites of importance to protect the identity, i.e. keep secret, certain sites, or to join Wahi Tapuna areas together. And we point to this in our hearing evidence 312, 313 and 314. In our hearing evidence 8.1, we also note private property owners like ourselves were not party to the Ngāi Claims Settlement Act 1998, and as such, our lawful rights and interests are not affected by its provisions. In Sarah Pickard's QLDC latest revisions, number 16 Punitapu area has no exemptions from the earthworks maximum of 10 cubic metres, as it is one of the seven areas captured in 25.5.11. It is unclear whether earthworks over 10 cubic metres in our area is restricted discretionary or non-complying. We consider this onerous given our underlying rural residential zoning allows 400 cubic metres as a permitted activity. Incidentally, in Dunedin, permitted earthworks maximum volumes on rural residential properties are not altered by the Wahi Tapuna overlay, providing there's no sediment runoff issues and less than 2 metres alteration to the ground level. A 4,000 square metre lot with a slope of 12 degrees or less is allowed 1,200 cubic metres per 2 year period in Dunedin, as opposed to 20 cubic metres proposed in 25.5.11 here. That's a massive difference. QLDC has previously assessed the zone areas within the district and deemed the receiving environment in our area suited for rural residential zoning, providing for subdivision and development of sites 4,000 square metres or greater, earthworks and building to sustain residential living. Also of note, QLDC is rating land, vacant land such as our rural residential lot at a higher value. Essentially, landowners are paying a penalty to own vacant land. The higher rating was adopted to encourage development of vacant land to create more housing opportunities. Wahi Tapuna overlay may now adversely affect the residential development of that land. The Wahi Tapuna provisions will trigger the need for resource consents that aren't necessary in a rural residential zone without the overlay. Every time we wish to undertake such an activity, our social and economic well-being will be affected through substantial additional costs, time delays and unnecessary stress, and then, depending on the outcome, may impact the use of the land. This is unreasonably onerous. So in conclusion, as submission and hearing evidence provide more in-depth information and description of what we want. In short, we believe the entire wahi tupuna policy and mapping should be deleted and readdressed in a more appropriate manner. QLDC should be required to undertake an in-depth independent study and evidence all sites and properties being included in the wahi tupuna areas. The policies must be fair and reasonable, criteria-driven, and more clearly defined for all parties subject to them. In the absence of any robust evidence, we consider number 16 Punatapu has been grossly oversized and needs to be re-evaluated. Removing properties outside of the immediate Punatapu Bob's Cove area, including our own, from the Wahi Tupuna mapping. As we state in our hearing evidence 10.3 and 10.4, we have attempted to gain a better understanding of why our properties have been designated Wahi Tupuna, and to date we still have no reasonable answers. However, we have gained some insight into our local history and some aspects of iwi's cultural values. Ngā mihi.
Thank you. First is in terms of page 2, talking about revisions.
Is this page 2 of our original?
Of the summary.
Oh, of the summary. Okay. Thank you. Yep.
The first bullet point out of the revisions. The intent of, like we've been talking to the planners about what this says and how it says it. But as I understand the intention, it is that to acknowledge that, as you say, a wide range of activities may have significant adverse effect on mana whenua values,
mm-hmm.
but it's not the wide range that have to be avoided. It's the, first of all, it's the activities that have those significant effects, and then it's the significant effects that have to be avoided. Now, that's a whole series of inquiries. So before you get to must avoid, there's a, like a sieve that you're reducing down the subject matter. And I wondered whether the concern you're expressing, which is a huge range of activities have to be avoided, might be considered a little overstated.
Not really. I think everything is, as we put out, what was that?
Yeah. Well, I guess it appeared to us with the changes in the use of the word must in there, that it is brings on a stronger meaning than the previous meaning, and it's unclear to us anyway when activities will actually be of threat or cause a major problem and when they won't. And I don't think it clearly defines that. And so once again, we've still got that problem of it saying must be avoided.
Anything and everything.
And you would have listened to Mr. Bailey who's making a similar point to us.
Yep.
And the next bullet point implies a cultural impact assessment may be required for any activities, even if you've already consulted with mana whenua. One of the things we've been discussing is whether that policy is even necessary, because that provision, insofar as it says what you've recorded it saying,
mm-hmm.
actually reflects the underlying law. Other provisions in the RMA that suggest that even if you've consulted, you may need to get a CIA, and obviously this isn't what you're looking at, but it would be standard practice for large entities with large applications to undertake a CIA on major projects irrespective of the extent of their consultation. And in fact, the consultation will inform their CIA.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking that the change, the what was formerly there would say, if you don't consult, you must do a CIA. That was criticised.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying now, you may need to do a CIA, irrespective of whether you consult or not, which reflects the existing law. Is that the concern you have, that you might be required to undertake a CIA?
Okay, yeah. Yes, to some degree what you're saying is correct. When we went to the meeting back in October with RUNACA representatives and QLDC representatives, at that meeting we were told that generally CIAs were really only needed for huge projects, you know, like offshore drilling and things like that. In fact, I think that's an example they used. But with the way the policy is worded now, if we had gone to Mana Whenua and had consultation, it doesn't say whether it's something small or something major. And we went back to council, and if, for example, Mana Whenua had some concerns of some sort, council could then turn around and go, oh, we want a CIA, even if those concerns were minor, or even if it was actually something that was permitted in our underlying zone. So I think for us, it comes across as being even more onerous than it was previously. And, you know, perhaps that's the wording, but it's unclear when a CIA is going to be needed, and once again, what's more than minor or what's going to be a major project?
Would it give you more comfort if it was clearer that CIAs would be or might be required where there are significant or potentially significant adverse effect on Mana Whenua values?
Well, you know, virtually our concern is that the 10 cubic metres, it catches anything and everything. So, you know, and we were told by the planners that that's what that was put in for, and Sarah Pickard and Mr. Bailey specifically told us that that's why that 10 cubic metres was put in there, to cover any and every threat.
And it's like a, I think it's, the way it's been expressed to us, it's like a trigger value bring things into the assessment, but that doesn't mean that an 11 cubic metre earthworks is going to have a significant adverse effect. Like, but I think the problem drafting these provisions is that depending on the location, as I say, whether you're on top of an archaeological site or a significant individual site, a relatively small earthworks may have a significant effect, but in most locations, it's going to take a lot more than that.
I guess the cost.
Yeah,
the cost.
I guess also from our point of view, because the mapping has been so broad, and we suggested in our submission and in our hearing evidence that we felt that it actually would have been more appropriate to ring fence the significant sites. That there's a lot of properties within the broad areas that possibly have no significance whatsoever, and as far as we can tell, our property is one of them. So 10 cubic metres is a very small amount of earthworks to do, and we've pointed out, you know, that we plant trees quite frequently. We've been working on planting indigenous plants all over the property. Doesn't take many trees at our property because you have to dig big holes because the ground's not great. Doesn't take many trees to actually end up triggering that 10 cubic metre rule. And to go to council for resource consent is going to be ridiculously expensive just for planting trees. You then go to Mana Whenua, and we would have to go to two Mana Whenua consultants and the costs involved there. And there's still no clear, as we were talking about the CIAs, there's still no clear indication as to where the council for some reason might go, oh, we're a bit concerned about this, you better get a CIA after you've already gone and gone for your resource consent and gone to Mana Whenua. So the costs are huge for people like ourselves on very small projects that, once again, we can do in our underlying zone as a permitted activity.
And that's a point you make that at page 3, that the end result will be consent hearings, possibly appeals,
yep,
on projects that might well be complying activities in the underlying zoning.
Correct.
And I think the, in terms of, well, why are we here, the counterpoint to that statement, like, it's obviously correct as a matter of fact, the counterpoint is that previously the underlying zoning didn't take Mana Whenua values into effect or into account, or if it did, it didn't give them nearly the same weight, on the basis that until the areas were mapped, it wasn't possible to do that. Now, the other way, so the other way to look at it is that this is a change to the previous position that reflects the need that, in fact, we're directed by various higher level documents that we're directed to take into account and recognise these Mana Whenua values and to avoid significant adverse effects on them. So it's not, so in terms of your talking about what Ms. Pickard has said to you, how, what she's written, she's tried to capture these higher level directions. But my point ultimately is that everyone's telling us that Chapter 39 is flawed. The other way to look at it is the PDP without Chapter 9 is flawed because it doesn't give adequate recognition to Wahi Tupuna values. So we're sort of between the proverbial rock and place,
but it could be done
trying to find a route through this.
Yeah.
What do you suggest?
Well, both our submission and our hearing evidence, and we take your point, and it isn't that we don't think Mana Whenua's values should be preserved. That's not the case at all.
Sure.
We do agree that they should be. Mm-hmm. It's how the process is undertaken. So in both our submission and our hearing evidence, we made the suggestion that specific sites, because Edward Allison actually points to it in his evidence, that they've taken broader areas so that they don't basically need to identify the specific sites of significance. Well, from our point of view, those specific sites of significance should be ring-fenced in some way, and all the rest of the properties that aren't of significance should not be mapped. And there could be a silent file, for example, that planners and council planners can go to, and we actually believe in Canterbury that that's how it's done. But those specific areas are ring-fenced, and obviously any requirements or special areas of importance about those areas are on file, and council were going to be able to look at that file and go, you're going to need to go to Mana Whenua, this is, you know, we need to consult with them. But I think with the bulk of the other properties that have been caught by the cloak, shall we say, of Mana Whenua in this situation with the broad mapping, we're once again also told at that meeting that with Runaka representatives in QLDC that Runaka may well go to the maps, have a look and go, oh yep, that's fine, there's no issue with that property. Well, if that's the case, why are the properties mapped in the first place? You know, we don't believe that it's a fair and reasonable way the plan's laid out.
I think that you raised a question that I wanted to ask you about. It was in your initial evidence. You're quoting Mr. Ellison.
Yep.
And while I recall him saying what you've recounted, I also recall him saying on the first day of hearing, as indeed his written evidence says, that the concept of Waiatupuna is inherently a broad landscape concept. It's not a site-specific concept. Now, I understand the point you're making about Site 16,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to ask you about that.
Yep.
Ask him, given the description of the values, how does that relate to the area? Because we've heard already today a number of people from the Closeburn area
mm-hmm.
raising that very question, and I should tell you that you didn't need to tell us because we'd already, well, at least I had wondered reading the description of the value because I've been through those values looking at each area, trying to see if the logic of what's been identified jumps out at me, and that was one that didn't. So, as I say, you didn't need to point it out, but I've got the message.
Thank you.
and so I will ask him. So put that aside, that his description, and I also understand that you are particularly interested in the Waiatupuna that affects you,
mm-hmm.
but his description was that Waiatupuna are inherently landscapes. They're not sites, they're not little individual areas. They're not necessarily huge, but they're not little areas which, as I understand it, compared to Waiatupuna,
mm-hmm.
which notoriously is a relatively small area. So I'm not sure that your characterisation of him is entirely fair, because were two arms to what he was saying.
He's talking about the metaphysical side of it.
I guess the other thing that we actually have in our hearing evidence is that, and we don't mean any disrespect to Mr. Ellison or the Runaka, but he speaks about the story, and obviously I think from what you're saying that this ties in to the Waiatupuna being about the story as much as about the individual specific sites. But once again, our point really is that this is a district plan, and it is very important for Maori cultural values to be taken into consideration. But once again, we've questioned that, is it fair and reasonable for everybody in the district, and not just Mana Whenua, if an entire story is being attempting to be told with the mapping, and consequently taking in broader areas and properties, once again, like our own, that don't appear to have any significance.
Mr. Hill.
Again, you say in your evidence you don't profess to be planners or lawyers, but you've clearly got your head around this issue from your perspective. And you've been having a discussion about the policy framework, but you've suggested in your statement here, you've used the Dunedin example. Is it that scale of effect or level of intervention that you would be more comfortable with it? Provisions remain. So I know you're concerned about the whole policy basis, what's it going to have it is determined.
Yeah.
But equally, it comes back to the threshold about when the rules kick in. I infer from what you're saying that if the rules are saying they should kick in at a higher level, but is what you've specified in Dunedin, you use as an example, but is that the kind of thing you would be expecting and be satisfied with?
The anything that's non-compliant or underlying zoning.
I don't need to me about the details.
Yeah,
so
I'm just
work out where this might head from your perspective.
Okay. Yeah, well, obviously, as we've said, from our perspective, we
want to go.
Yeah. But essentially, yes, in an area like rural residential, the thresholds, we actually feel, unless there's absolutely a site of significance that has something archaeological on it, that our underlying zoning, in actual fact, our underlying zoning levels are less than Dunedin anyway. So our underlying zoning earthworks level, we believe we should be allowed to continue on that basis. And so we would be more comfortable if there was something like what Dunedin has in it about sediment runoff and, you know, something along those lines would be more appropriate, I think, yes. But we've also stated that we're happy for non-complying activities in our underlying zones, that any of those applications could be sent directly to Mana Whenua and they could have the opportunity then to submit or require, you know, further consultation on those on those activities. We're more than happy for that.
So just to continue that for a slight, so are you saying to us, if these provisions remain, there should also be a two-tiered approach? There should be an identification of what is significant and a particular set of rules applied to that versus the other things. It's currently being sort of worked out through the policy framework. Are you suggesting that they should be identified, these other sites which are areas which are really significant for these reasons? We still have concerns or values on the others, but they are at a lower level? Or is that second more on what you're saying?
I guess that's an option. I don't know how realistic that would be for the council, but I mean, we do believe that if there are specific sites that have archaeological values on them, or if there is something of, you know, major importance, then there should be some information immediately available to council planners that when an application comes in on one of those sites, they're going to go, oh, okay. That way, you know, those sites are going to be better preserved, and red flag will be raised, I guess you could say.
That's all the different zones and
build
lines.
On our short summary, if you have a look on the
map at the back,
which we'd included just to point out, we weren't sure you'd have where our property was, so we thought we'd better include that. But if you take a look at that, that shows the zoning in the Punatapu area. And the red line is basically our rough line of where the Wahi Tupuna covers. And in our area, for example, there is a no-build zone. And that's the blue kind of striped areas. And I think there are no-build zones in a few areas. So there's things like that already in place to prevent building in sensitive areas. I think there could be something along those lines, even if it's a silent file for council, for the areas that are of more significance.
Dunedin doesn't have a
secret. Thank you very much.
Just leave it.
Yes, did you mention somewhere that your property is currently a vacant lot? Is that
one of our properties is, yes.
Was that the lower or upper?
Well, they're actually both on the same level.
Oh, right.
Lot one is at the moment vacant.
And you just went through that you do a lot of planting work. What other activities do you anticipate that you would be wanting to do in the future?
Well, it's rural residential. It's rural residential, so it's already anticipated there's going to be building and structures there. So in the near future, we'll build or somebody else will build there and earthworks will have to be done for earthworks will have to be done for a building. It's a continuing process. Like, we've owned the place for 30 years, and it was like a wilding pine forest when we bought it, and now it's sort of its own ecosystem with all the indigenous plants we've put in and all the bird life and that we've brought back. And it's a continuing thing that we're doing with the property. So it's not as though something will just wake up and go, oh, we're going to dig 10 cubic metres tomorrow. But it happens all the time. We're doing something, we're doing a garden, we're putting a greenhouse in, we're doing something, and 10 cubic metres isn't that significant of earthworks because it's cut and fill. So if you, and all the soil in our area has been sort of ruined by all the pine forests and that. So when we take dirt out, we have to put new soil back in. So if you dig 5 out and put 5 new in, that's 10. So that makes it even more restrictive in that respect. So in rural residential, you're always, because it's rural, you're always planting, you're always doing something to enhance your property. If that sort of...
Well, we are, anyway.
We are, and most of our neighbours in the area are doing exactly the same thing, taking out all the wilding pines and putting indigenous
species.
Dealing
with gorse and broom. You know, it's just an ongoing process.
But there's no live subdivision or existing building platform identified on that other lot?
Rural residential doesn't have a designated building platform. The whole area is the building platform.
I just wanted to actually comment that for starting out your submission by saying you're neither planners nor lawyers, you've done a fantastic job of representing yourselves and your interests.
Yep.
I've often described the RMA and the district plans process as being somewhat impenetrable to the members of the community, and I think you've demonstrated that that lay people can get in there and do a very good job of representing themselves. So well done with that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I might stop and have a cup of coffee.